Okay, so I'm going to talk of even a different kind of solid, following up on Jim's. So I really want to make maybe some even heretical statements. So I want to talk about granular solids, and I'm asking about a very basic question, which is, what do I mean by rigidity in these kinds of solids? So I want to get one message across, if nothing else, is that you have to think of these solids slightly differently from other amorphous solids of the kind that Mathieu talked about. So I'm really going to focus near the jamming point of dry grains, and I will go through some arguments trying to convince you that we need to think of them differently than other amorphous solids and their plasticity, etc. I'll not talk much about plasticity or yielding. The basic message will be that we might have to think of them differently. And so my aim is to establish a framework, and then we'll use experiments from Bob Berenger's group that we have analyzed to establish that framework to a certain extent. So before I go on, the work that has been that I'll be talking about theoretically has been done by Sumantra Sarkar and Jia Peng or Max B. And it's been an invaluable collaboration with Bob's group, Bob, Jay Zhang, Jay Ren, Joshua Deitzman. So we couldn't have done what we've done without them. Okay, so I was initially going to talk about a statistical framework, a sort of an attempt to build a unified statistical framework for both the kind of shear thickening that Eric talked about and shear jamming that Bob will talk about later on, and I'll mention. But I decided to really focus on this framework, but there's a poster by Sumantra where he talks about the statistical framework, so you guys should go to that to learn about that aspect of the work. Okay, so what do I want to focus on? So let me define my system. So I'm really looking at dry grains, purely repulsive contact interactions. There are no thermal fluctuations because these are big systems. They are strictly at zero temperature. Thermal fluctuations don't do anything to them. I'm going to look at real granular systems, so frictional contact. So there are frictional forces. So positions don't tell me everything about forces. Because it's zero temperature, they stay in a single microscopic configuration unless driven. And the kind of driving that I'll think about is shear. I'm also, as I said before, sort of looking at this limit of where things are just touching so that contacts breaking and forming play an important role. And the question I'm asking is, I'm going back to the kind of condensed matter questions that we ask, is what gives these systems rigidity? So I'm going to start by talking about how we understand it from very basic principles in standard amorphous systems. So crystals, of course, have some obvious broken translational symmetry, and we associate shear rigidity or generalized elasticity to that broken symmetry. Even if I have an amorphous solid, I know I have broken continuous translational symmetry in that system in the following sense. So I don't know how to actually characterize it. There's no periodic order. But in the following sense, that the patterns of particles is inhomogeneous. So if I look at rho of r, the density function, the density field, it's non-uniform, averaged, let's say, over time. If my amorphous solid is at finite temperature, I look at it as a function of time, and I get a non-zero, a non-constant value of the density. And the patterns of particles persist as they're not destroyed by thermal fluctuations. And their rigidity, then, I can relate to the fact that these patterns also persist under strain to some extent, so that my patterns don't completely disappear, so they resist the shearing, which is why. So a pattern is needed to resist the shear, and that leads to shear rigidity. So I have some kind of broken translational symmetry in this space. Traditionally, so that's one aspect of it, and the second aspect is, traditionally, I have either energy or entropic energy or entropy changes driving the transition from a fluid to an amorphous solid. So if I have these kinds of solids, which I have actually bonding, cohesive interactions, there's an energetic preference for some kinds, for these metastable states, these amorphous structures over the fluid structures. Or if I look at colloidal systems, we know now very well for many, many years now that there are entropic preferences for solid-like structures. So now I'm going to, the system that I'm interested in is dry grains, so no cohesive interactions and no thermal fluctuations. So neither of these can be instrumental in making my grains want to be in some kind of structure where they can resist shear. So that's one of the questions. So there are two sort of questions. What is the basic mechanism that can actually lead to shear rigidity? And then how do we describe the shear rigidity? So what I'm going to say, it's a pretty strong statement, and I'm willing to be heckled later on after I finish my talk. So what I want to say is that in these kinds of systems, in the dry grains, the broken translational symmetry that we associate with shear rigidity or generalized elasticity is a necessary but not a sufficient condition for rigidity. And the reason is pretty simple. The reason is contacts can break. So if I have very, very small fluctuations of these positions which break my contacts, they don't necessarily destroy my positional correlations. They don't destroy these patterns. But they can actually lead to failure because the forces that are essential for giving us this rigidity can change enormously. And I can get yielding, plastic instabilities, et cetera, coming from contact breaking. So this is what I want to convince you today is there is another over on top of this broken translational symmetry in real space. We need for a granular solid to be rigid, we need to break translational symmetry in another kind of space that, for the lack of a better word, I'm calling a reciprocal space, and that will be the first part of my talk, is defining for you what this reciprocal space is. And then how do we detect broken translational symmetry in that space? So since I'm not going to talk much about yielding or instabilities at all, and since this workshop is mostly about these large fluctuations and instabilities, I just want to say at this point that I think because of the fact that there is sort of this additional condition on granular solids to make them rigid, that the yielding and instabilities also have to be thought about differently. Okay. So if I'm looking at zero temperature cohesionless systems, my claim is that the only thing that can come into play are the constraints of mechanical equilibrium, the forces and torque balance. So I want to think of these systems statistically, right? So I think you need to think of an ensemble. So the ensemble that I'm thinking about are the ensemble of states, zero temperature, no cohesive interactions, which are under local force and torque balance under some imposed stresses. If I don't give you any imposed stresses, then these granular systems have no rigidity. There's nothing that keeps them together. There's no cohesion. There's no thermal fluctuations that gives you some entropic preference for some states. So I have to tell you what are the stresses I'm imposing on the system, and under those imposed stresses, each grain has to be under local force and torque balance. So these, to me, are sort of equality constraints. So each grain has to satisfy two equality constraints. Forces have to sum up to zero, torques have to sum up to zero. And the total stresses in the system have to add up to the global stresses that are imposed. Then I have these two inequality constraints, which in a statistical way are very difficult to impose. One is the Coulomb inequality. So I have frictions, but the tangential forces have to be less than or equal to the friction coefficient times the normal force, so the static condition. And the normal forces are all positive. So what I'll try to do is construct a framework where we can see what the influences of all of these constraints are. And what I would like you to take away from this talk is that a combination of these constraints can lead to correlations, can lead to some kind of broken translational symmetry in this reciprocal space or space of forces. So let me go through first introducing this framework, which imposes the constraints of force and torque balance rigorously. And for the rest of my talk, I'm going to talk only about two-dimensional systems. There might be a way of extending these to 3D, but really, I'm happy to say that all we are talking about, all that we have done so far, is restricted to 2D. Okay, so there are essentially two sets of auxiliary forces that I need to introduce. There are some vector fields that enforce the constraints of force balance on every grain. And this is first introduced, as far as I know, in 2002. Then we did some work, and Eric, who's a postdoc with Mathieu now, did some very, very nice work that we've been trying to use. So there are some vector fields that enforce force balance. There's an additional scalar field, the torque balance. These are the nature of these fields are sort of gauge fields. They impose constraints. There's a relation between these two, the scalar fields and the vector forces, vector fields. So let me first just look at the vector fields, which enforce force balance, and tell you how they're defined. So these blue things are my grains. At every contact, there's a vector force. Because it's frictional, the forces don't have to necessarily point along the lines joining the center to the contact. And you can introduce, so what I know is my forces have to sum up to zero. So on this grain, F1 plus F2 plus F3 plus F4 has to sum up to zero. So what I can introduce is what Ball and Blumenthal call loop forces. So essentially, it's sort of a vectorial currents that live on these loops. And these loops are defined geometrically, and I can get into more detail with people later on. But they're connecting the contacts on every grain. And in all of these kinds of mappings, there's always a convention. And the convention that we adopt is that we are going always counterclockwise. So since the gauge fields, I can choose an origin somewhere. So there, let me choose it here. So here there is a vector field that we call height. So the height is zero here, but it's a vector height. It's zero here. The rule is as I cross this contact force, I increment it by F1. So these are missing the vectors. So this is a vector F1, F1 plus F2, F1 plus F2 plus F3. I come back to zero because the forces add up to zero. Okay, I can construct a dual network to this strictly, which says that I can forget about the grains. I can look at these networks, and I have sort of the circulating fields, which are these heights, which are zero, F1, F1 plus F2 plus F3, et cetera. These are continuous fields, so people who have worked with height models before, this is more aimed at them. So these are continuous vector fields, and they live on a random network defined by these loops. Okay, so algebraically, what have I done? I have said, okay, so there are some contact forces which are vectors, and if I denote my height vectors by rho, then I have these two loops, let's say. And the difference between the heights between these two loops, which are sitting surrounding the voids, is the contact force that connects these two loops. So every loop every contact force shares two loops. And then there's this torque balance condition that I'm not going to talk about too much, which can be enforced through an additional scalar field, phi. And there's a relationship between them. I'll come back to the torque balance later on, but the height vectors are what are crucial in constructing my reciprocal space. So what's the point? The point is that I can take any configuration of the rows and phis, and they will generate for me a force and torque balance network. So the force and torque balance are automatically satisfied by the rows and phis, or the other way of saying it is I needed force and torque balance to be able to introduce these fields. Okay, so now in the next slide, I'm going to just focus on the height vectors to construct what I call this reciprocal space. So I'm now focusing only on the force balance. The force balance, so there's just these height vectors. Oh, and I'm sorry about this. I changed notation. What was rho before is h now. Really sorry about that. So, but the rows are the h's. So if I look at a particular grain, there's also this very nice geometrical representation. So let's say I start from h0, and I can go from h0 to h1 just by drawing the force vector that connects them, right? So I can go from h0 to h1, that's the force vector f1, which can have a tangential component. So every grain now has a polygon associated with it, because the forces laid head to tail form a polygon. They have to add up to zero. And the vertices of these polygons are those heights. So what I have completely, if I look at this picture, I've essentially lost all of the real space geometric information, but the topological information will be there, because if this is grain one, and then let's say grain one shares for F4 with some other grain 2, that grain will also have a polygon associated with it, and it will share an edge with that. So what I'll end up, the reciprocal space that I'm talking about, will have tiles that cover a plane. And so let me go into a little bit more detail about that. So these black dots are just those red points. So this is actually a tiling that we created from one of Bob Berenger's experiments, and then I've sort of erased the tiles for a very particular reason, which I'll come to in a minute. So what is this? These are these height vectors that I started off. So I started off from some arbitrary origin, let's say here, and then I have all of these heights that I can generate from the tiles. So these points are just the vertices, and they're connected in some way through the polygons that I haven't drawn for you yet. But there's one more point here that I want to, there is one more feature that I want to point out. So all of these height vectors have to fit into a bounding box, which are defined by two vectors, Fy and Fx. And what these are is this is the fact that the total stress has to add up to the global stresses, the local stresses. So if I march along my granular system and go along the y direction, there will be some force vector which make up my stress tensor, which I call Fy. And then if I go along my x direction, there's another total force vector, Fx. And all of my heights have to fit into that. And what I mean by that is if I go from here to that side, there's a difference in height, so there's a tilt in this height space. That's defined by Fy. And if I go along the x direction, there is a different tilt in the height space, which is defined by Fx. And within this, if I have n loops in my system, I'll have n vertices. And the question that we will look for, the question that we are asking is, so any set of such points gives me a force balance configuration. So if I didn't have the torque balance or any of the other constraints, I have satisfied the force balance, and they live in this bounding box, so I satisfy the global constraint. So if that's all I had, I could just put any set of points in here, and there should not be no correlations, no rigidity in this space. So what I'm going to argue is that the other constraints have to provide some correlations between these points so that I can't just, through a Poisson process, throw down points inside this box. And that, the crux of my argument is going to be that those other constraints and I don't have any rigorous proof for it, gives rise to broken translational symmetry in this space. So if I forgot about the fact that these are these height points and thought of these as atoms, I could ask, what's the density of points here? And does the density of points develop some pattern under certain external conditions? There is one very important thing here, which hopefully should come in the next. Yes. So I have used the fact here that all the forces are positive, that the forces are repulsive. Because if I actually had negative forces, if I had attractive interactions, I could be marching up my system. And let's say I had a height origin that I had picked here, which is zero, I could have come back to the origin someplace else, because I could have gone up in forces, and then I had negative forces enough that I could come back. But with positive forces, the height is monotonic, so I keep monotonically going up. So what I'm, another way of saying this is that if I had actually attractive forces, I would have multiple sheets of these points. I would go partway, and then I'll come back to the origin somewhere, I'll fill up another sheet, come back to an origin, etc., etc. So the positivity of the forces makes this a useful construct. With cohesive forces, it's a much more complicated scenario. Okay, so the reciprocal space that I referred to is this tiling of polygons whose vertices are the heights. Okay, so these are the two still mechanical stability constraints that I have not imposed yet. And I really don't know how to do this statistically. So I'm going to just argue and then show comparisons to experiments. So the basic question we are asking is, do these introduce correlations? And there's one system where we know that they have to. So if I have frictionless systems, so all of the, there are no tangential forces, the forces have to point along the normal. And if my grains actually have convex shapes, then these force polygons that I talked about also have to be convex. So that has to introduce correlations. So how do I see that? So here I've just made up a tiling where it's all convex polygons. So the statistical ensemble that I want to think about is if I have defined for I, the statistical ensemble is defined by fx and fy, so these are my global stresses, and I'm trying to think of an ensemble where I have equal probability of finding any microscopic state that's consistent with this fx, fy, and satisfy my mechanical stability criteria, force, torque balance, etc. So now, if I have this constraint of polygons being convex shaped, let me try and do a thought experiment. I could try and move this point arbitrarily somewhere else, and I could move it only up to here, and then I would violate the convexity condition. So what I'm trying to say is that if I had no convexity condition, then I could move these points arbitrarily far, arbitrarily, there would be no rigidity, I could destroy this pattern. But the convexity condition is one example of how I can introduce some correlations between these patterns and lead to a broken translational symmetry in this space. So what do I mean by that? Just like I could do in position space, I could define a density field. I can count the number of points, let's say in this small box, call it some rho of h. So rho of h is really a point density in this space, not in position space, in this reciprocal space. And I can ask whether that's a constant or not when I average over all possible configurations that are consistent with the fx, fy, and with this convexity condition. So I have, if this is true, then in frictionless systems, my claim is that as soon as you get force balance, you're going to get rigidity. But that's not going to be true for frictional systems. So what I'm, this is an argument saying this is how I could get correlations. This will be my measure of whether I have broken translational symmetry in this space. So that's my rigidity argument. And the way I would translate the usual kind of strain shear modulus argument is, instead of straight thinking of strain, I'll ask if I change fx a little bit or fy a little bit, what happens to this pattern? And if that pattern can actually resist the fx, fy changes, then there is some rigidity to this. So does the pattern persist? So that would be my test of rigidity. So what I've tried to say here is convexity is one way of introducing correlations. But I'm interested in frictional systems. And in frictional systems, you actually can get non-convex times. So I don't have to, how many minutes do I have left? 2 minutes? Oh, good. Okay. So I don't have much time to go into this, but it's easy to see that if you have frictional forces and some imbalance of forces, that grains have some very large forces and some small forces, and they have to satisfy torque balance, you end up with these kinds of polygons. So with those, I cannot use the convexity condition. My claim is that even though I don't have a rigorous theory of how of figuring out how these two constraints restrict the kinds of polygons that I get, they have to. I have some rough idea of what it does. But since I really am not on very firm footing there, I'm going to take the easy way out. I'm going to analyze experiments from Bob Berenger's group using this framework of reciprocal space and show you that there is broken translational symmetry that arises there at the jamming transition. But the jamming transition that I'll be talking about is shear-induced jamming. So I need to say a little bit about the experiment and show you a picture. So this is an experiment where things are, and Bob will talk much more about this in his talk. No, you're not going to talk about it? I'll talk a little bit. Okay. So this is sitting on a table, so there's no gravity anywhere. And the system is being sheared. And what you see is the formation of these force chains. And through many, many other sort of measures, we know that at some point, at some shear strain, and this should also remind you of the kind of pictures that Eric Brown showed you this morning, where you have these, there they were contact, here there are force-bearing structures. And they, as you keep shearing it, you get more and more contacts. The system becomes more isotropic. And at some point, from various measures, we call the system as being shear jammed. Okay. So from these various other measures, we had constructed a phase diagram. Sorry about that. Constructed a phase diagram that was published a couple of years ago. So this is a variation on the phase diagram that Eric Corbin showed you this morning. This is sitting at zero temperature, no temperature at all. This is the packing fraction axis. This is the shear stress axis. This is a schematic. This is the lowest packing fraction at which you can get any kind of jammed state. And my contention is this is the point at which, this is the lowest density at which you can get broken translational symmetry in position space. So the system, if I looked at this at a small infinitesimal temperature, then I would actually have an amorphous or a glass structure, at a low temperature glass structure. This is the point which has been associated with frictionless jamming, at which you can get isotropic jam structures. In between here, there are different, at a given packing fraction, I can get unjammed states, what we call fragile states, and these are sort of robust jam states, which are shear jam states. So what I'm asking, going to show you later, showing you in the next couple of slides, is this transition from the fragile to shear jam states is marked by the onset of broken symmetry in this reciprocal space. But if I ask for broken translational symmetry in position space, every state here has that. So let me just quickly... this is just to show that we do actually, from the experiment, see these non-convex polygons. Okay. So this is just what happens to the force tiles, and I don't have much time to go into it because I want to show you a quantitative measure. So to come up with a quantitative measure, we did sort of something that people have done in other disordered systems. I come up with an overlap matrix. So alpha and beta are, let's say, two strain steps in this experiment. And I can look at the density pattern at the alpha step and the beta step, and I take an overlap of those two. If the pattern can sustain the shearing, then the overlap would be large. If it cannot, the overlap will be small, and that's what we're looking for. So this is the persistence of structure. So here is, so this is an overlap matrix. So strain, strain, and the color code is telling you how large that overlap is. So if I look in real space, then starting from about here, the overlap is pretty large throughout this box. If I now look in this reciprocal space and do exactly the same thing, I'm looking at the density, but density of these height points, what you see is even within this regime, which seemed boring from the positional space, you have this well-defined structure. So what this is telling me is that if I created a state by shearing at this strain step, then up to that strain step, the pattern persists. And beyond that, it fails. So this is plasticity, yielding, whatever you want to call it, but it's not being picked up by looking at the positional space pattern. I'm sure if you looked at contacts very closely, you will. But it shows up dramatically in this space, in this space of forces, for the lack of a better word. Just wanted to show you that if we looked at low density and high density, the same reciprocal space, and these blacks are just, these are all from experiments. We didn't do any simulations. These are just missing states. You essentially see the same kind of structure, but the shear jamming onset is at lower strains, and it lasts for longer. Okay, so we can define an order parameter. I'm going to skip that. So since this is a workshop about large fluctuations, et cetera, what I've shown you so far is that shear can actually induce solidification, right, from this perspective. Shear leads to, by shearing enough, I can get a state that's robust to further shearing. That's the only sense in which I can think of rigidity. But because people are interested in plastic deformations, et cetera, what I'm showing you here, this is the same overlap picture, but I have thresholded it, and I'm showing you only the regions that are overlap is more than 50%. So if I look at these points, then you see that there are failures happening. And what we have tracked here is this number of non-convex polygons as a function for the same strain step. So these two points that are shown here these are the corresponding force tiles, and the red points mark where the non-convex tiles are. So what I want people to think about is, yes, there are localized modes of failures in these systems, but they are visible in this force space, in this reciprocal space mapping, as a very prominent geometrical structure, which are non-convex polygons. So what happens when there's a failure is the number of non-convex polygons actually go down. Then they keep going up again, going down, etc. So I know this has been quick, this has been sort of dirty, but the message that I want to get across, which is hopefully in the summary, is that forces and positions have to be treated separately in frictional systems. And when, even in frictionless systems, when I'm close to this contact breaking point, then I don't think positional breaking translational symmetry in position space guarantees rigidity. I need broken translational symmetry in the space of forces. And it makes sense to me, because the only thing that imparts rigidity to these systems are these constraints of force and torque balance. So my message is that we need to think slightly differently about these granular solids, which are close to jamming, so contact breaking and forming have a major influence, and where I have frictional forces. So with that, I'm going to stop.
Thank you. nice presentation. Can you go to the last line, the one before? Here you plotted out those N versus strength steps. You see some fluctuations. Any special meaning regarding the intrinsic behavior of those fluctuations?
Say that again.
You have any intrinsic behavior of those fluctuations in your...
Do number? I have statistics of this?
Any intrinsic...
Okay, so what's going on is, so I have this number of non-convex polygons going up and going down again. The reason, so there's a basic competition in the system. So the non-shearing something, which is giving me larger shear stresses, is better accommodated by these non-convex polygons. They can actually better accommodate shear stress because the geometric mapping is the shear stress is like the area minus the perimeter square. So it likes non-convex polygons. But the non-convex polygons are fragile and susceptible to being if I create more, so shear is doing two things here. It's giving you shear rigidity, it's increasing the shear stress. It's also increasing the number of contacts. So as I increase the number of contacts, I have to necessarily reduce the number of non-convex polygons because they take up, they are not as compact. So that's the competition. So they keep going up, and then at some point, they're like defects that the system doesn't like to have rigidity. So there is a collective failure of a bunch of them. But if you're asking me, do I know what I would love to do is figure out what the interactions are between these defects, right, which I don't know yet. But they're not defects in a positional sense.
I know that you'd said you don't want to talk about dimensions other than two, but is it possible to define this reciprocal space in 3D, or is it
algebraically but not geometrically, because the things that are vectors here actually become tensors, but Eric has an algebraic formulation in 3D. Don't know how to think about it geometrically.
So it's very coincidental that you basically asked my question. But let me follow it up. So it seems that the biggest issue in trying to do something similar in 3D is how do you go around, right? So in 2D, you can say clockwise, right?
Not just that. The fields themselves become tensors, so I don't know how to represent them.
Well, the contact forces are still vectors, right?
The contact forces are still vectors.
And around any particle, they would close up, right?
The contact forces still are, but the heights are no longer vectors.
But if you could figure out a way of enumerating through all the contacts, I guess that's the bigger issue, right? There's going to be many ways to go through it. You don't have a singular rule that could basically...
That is also true.
Right, but is it true? Maybe you could have a set of height fields that would correspond to a given origin.
No,
is that not possible?
No, there is a unique height field that can be
3D?
Shown algebraically, but it's a tensor, it's not a scalar.
Even
in 3D. Exactly. Yeah.
So that just, from a theorist point of view, it's still a perfectly defined model.
Yes, I just cannot represent it in geometrically in some very nice way to give me some intuition.
Right.
Yeah. If I knew how to impose those inequality constraints algebraically, I could do this, I think, in 3D. But I just don't know how to do it.
Okay, how many dimensions would that be?
Huh?
How many dimensions would that be in 3D?
The height vector becomes, I think it's just embedded in 4D. So I think it's just a 2x, I've forgotten what the tensor structure of that is. But yeah, it's some higher dimension.
Oh, okay.
It's not a vector.
Okay, so here's my question. I understand that these are apparently local plastic events. But do they show up as some kind of like more global stick slip like behavior? This kind of failure events?
I don't know. This is all, so as I said, all we have done is analyzed experiments.
Yeah.
And these are the only kinds of, if you want to call them stick slippy events, that are seen in these experiments. There's no large scale failure. There are no shear bands in these systems.
Okay. Okay, though I don't think you need shear bands for large-scale failure.
Yes, so I never said anything about large-scale failure. I guess the only thing I'm pointing out is that there are structures which are very easy to pick up in here because it's geometric. It's a qualitative difference between convex polygons and non-convex polygons.
Right.
And what we have seen is that, so what I didn't plot here is stress drops. So these are going to line up completely with stress drops.
Mm-hmm.
So this is rising shear stress, and the shear stress drops a little bit.
Right.
And those are completely correlated with what happens to these non-convex polygons.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
that's the clear correlation we have, is the shear stress is correlated with the number of non-convex polygons.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But so if I look at a system where there's a large stress drop, I would guess that that's associated with these. If we have shear bands, so Bob has some experiments where there are shear bands, and we haven't looked at them carefully to see what happens.
Okay.
But these are small systems.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Let me just add a quick comment. I just feel that there are going to be parallels between what you're seeing and what Eric Brown was talking about this morning, and perhaps even what I've been doing lately, and presumably what Jim is going to be talking about tomorrow. So I might just advertise a little bit on the role of friction in some kind of instabilities that we are seeing in shear granular flow.
So Eric Brown's talk was not about instabilities. It was about shear inducing rigidity, and I completely agree. So I think what we have been trying to understand is shear induced rigidity, and yes. We are working with the Jeff Morris group to construct these tiles and see what happens. Unfortunately, I don't have this geometrical picture in 3D that can give me some intuition.
So
hi, Buwal. So as you know, but mostly for the audience's benefit, when we've looked at a related measure, the angoricity, we saw that the amount of pressure and the amount of shear in a system, it partitioned itself in a very specific way that is presumably related to the coefficient of friction. That, you know, when Bob and I pick our particles, we don't pick the coefficient of friction.
Correct.
It picks us.
Mm-hmm.
So to what extent is it possible to cast the coefficient of friction, which is a scalar, as some constraint on the kinds of shapes that you see? Because it seems like you don't think it is.
I think it's related to the, if I look at a particular global stress, what's the fraction of non-convex to convex that I get?
And you think that is
related to your friction coefficient.
And that seems like something that is a tunable parameter that might be how this constraint comes in. Okay, so you think that this is doable, it's just that we don't know how to do it. Okay.
So what other question? I mean, officially we are supposed to be done, right? Now, but if we have one more question. Okay, great. Thanks to all the speakers.